You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Hawaiian Gardens sits on the southeast edge of LA County between the 605 and Coyote Creek. At 1 square mile, it is LA's smallest city. It's got streets of stucco homes with grassy lawns, a park, and the Gardens Casino, of course. What it doesn't have is a place to get a COVID-19 vaccine.
We would love to get the vaccines, but it's such a hassle. I mean, you have to drive way out. You got to wait in line for hours.
Eddie Garcia is an aerospace engineer who's lived here since he was a third grader. And he's his mother's caretaker. She has Alzheimer's. And at 67, she is eligible for the vaccine, but she still has yet to get one. Hawaiian Gardens is one of the county's least vaccinated cities. Typically, the closest appointments are many miles away. Meanwhile, Garcia says almost every other day, there's an ambulance that pulls up to his condo complex.
I feel awful, you know. It's really sad. We lost a few of our people that we've known for so long, since I was a little boy. I basically grew up here. And it's sad, you know, when you have to see them get, you know, pulled out with, like, people in hazmat suits and stuff. And it's like, man, that could have been preventable.
Now, LA County has been focused recently on an equitable vaccine rollout. But the reality is residents in some cities, like Hawaiian Gardens, are still feeling ignored. KCRW's Kaylee Wells has this story about one small city's colossal challenge to help its most vulnerable residents.
It was just before Christmas that Carl Kulzer started getting headaches. He felt dizzy and really, really tired.
I went for a test here in the Hawaiian Gardens, only 1 mile from the house.
He found out a week later he was positive for COVID-19. He's since recovered and is doing well, but after that, he was determined to get protected.
So I thought, hey, I better get this damn shot as soon as I can. I'm 83 years old. I'm no kid anymore.
At age 83, he's been eligible to get a vaccine since mid-January. He says he's not too good at online stuff, so he called. And he sat on hold for an hour.
She said they were fully booked. This is for Los Angeles County, the closest one being Downey for me.
But even if the Downey location was taking appointments, that's 10 miles away, and that's farther than Kulzer drives these days.
I still drive. I don't drive much, but what I do is I go out with my walker, put it in the trunk of the car, and then I hold on to the side of the car and get in. But I try to limit my drives to, you know, 4 or 5 miles or whatever, maybe a little more. But Downey from here would, like I said, I try to just stay close to home. It's frustrating, but what could I do?
Kulzer wasn't finding an appointment, but he was getting a lot closer than some of his neighbors. He has internet access, he has a car, and he has the time to sit on the phone for an hour to get an appointment. That's not typical here. The median household income is 30% lower than the county average. A quarter of residents here live below the poverty line. So why are the shots so hard to come by near Hawaiian Gardens? Well, the city shares borders with Long Beach and with Orange County. Both have their own health departments with their own pool of shots that Hawaiian Gardens residents don't have access to. None of the local doctor's offices administer the vaccine. A couple nearby pharmacies have it, but they're not on the state's appointment portal.
It's no coincidence that many of our smaller communities have had the highest rates of infection, and that's based on income levels, right?
Myra Maravilla is a council member in Hawaiian Gardens, and she's been fighting for the County Department of Public Health's attention.
It's been really frustrating for us because the map shows the need, and although everyone is talking about equity, there's no action to really turn that around. The talk of equity, the talk of inequities, the disparities, that doesn't mean anything unless the people that have the opportunity to make these changes actually make those changes.
She says attempts to get a vaccination site in Hawaiian Gardens, or even in Cerritos, the next town over, have been met with red tape. She says she's asked for help from the LA County supervisors, from the Department of Public Health, from local congresspeople, even the White House COVID response team. And she's still waiting.
I would hate to see more residents from Hawaiian Gardens die because they just couldn't get that vaccine in time.
LA County Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer says the vaccine equity problem is far from solved. But the answer isn't putting a vaccination site in every neighborhood.
In many of our communities, the most trusted people that folks would like to get vaccinated from are providers that are already there. And our strategy really has been to figure out ways to help them build their capacity.
Mara Villa says that strategy doesn't work in a place like Hawaiian Gardens.
In smaller cities, you really have like fewer resources to begin with. And so to say, oh, we're just going to partner with what's already there, it's like, well, there's really not much here. In other cities, they just, you know, go through their doctor. But a lot of people here don't have a doctor.
LA County has promised it'll fill that gap with mobile clinics and pop-up vaccination sites. And with the arrival of the more easily distributed Johnson & Johnson vaccine, the capacity to do that has tripled this week. Mara Villa hasn't gotten any good news about that effort either.
It's been really hard. And, you know, we've been asking for these mobile unit sites and we haven't received any, and we haven't really received any leads either. So I don't know. It's just like a waiting game, I guess. But it's interesting how they do come up with these sites, because all the data that's out there really points to our communities are underserved and we're just kind of left to fend for ourselves in what seems to be like Wild Wild West situation.
This is all really discouraging to Hawaiian Gardens resident Eddie Garcia. Even as case numbers fall and vaccination rates continue to climb, he isn't feeling hopeful just yet. After the past year, he's distrustful of local officials' optimism.
Do I feel things are personally getting better? No, I don't. I honestly don't. I don't feel that there's enough vaccines, and I don't feel that there's enough being done to really help maybe the more lower class or working class societies of California.
Even though his mother with Alzheimer's is over 65, he's waiting for the vaccine rollout to iron out the kinks before he takes her to an unfamiliar place and get a needle put in her arm. Until then, he's prioritizing her physical health and safety, keeping her friends and family at an arm's distance. But Garcia's neighbor, Carl Kulzer, heard about another option through the grapevine, also known as his weekly bridge game. He was going to get vaccinated, even if it meant lying.
So then I talked to some people I play bridge with. She was an ex-resident of Long Beach, and she lied about living in Long Beach.
Kulzer lived in Long Beach, too, for 30 years. That is until his landlord sold his apartment a couple years back and his rent more than doubled.
But I have a senior ID card with my old Long Beach address on it. And I thought, well, that might be enough to do it. Well, long story short, when they set me up,
he called to make the appointment. And the health department said they knew his address was in Hawaiian Gardens. The jig was up.
And I said, yeah, that's true. And I said, am I still eligible? And he said, yes.
He managed to get the shot anyway. He just got his second dose last Saturday. It's a happy ending for Kulzer. But for everyone else without internet or a car, without a network of crafty bridge players, it's a high-stakes waiting game, and the deck is stacked against them. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Well, Hawaiian Gardens isn't the only place where it's difficult to get vaccinated. It is a problem in a lot of neighborhoods, especially those filled with essential workers who may not have access to high-speed internet or their own car, or maybe have their own flexible schedules to head out the minute an appointment opens up. Vaccine equity is a term you've probably heard a lot lately. So what does that look like on the streets of Los Angeles? Well, it means, at least it likely means, some of the most at-risk and vulnerable people to COVID-19 are not getting potentially life-saving shots. Manuel Pastor heads up USC's Equity Research Institute. He's also a member of Governor Gavin Newsom's COVID Recovery Task Force. Hey, Manuel.
Hey, good to be with you this morning.
And Erica Smith is a columnist at the LA Times. She's been writing about vaccine equity as well. Erica, welcome.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Manuel, I'm going to start with you because, you know, I guess the first question is, how would you define vaccine equity and how does it differ from equality?
What vaccine equity means is designing with equity at the beginning, understanding where it is that the disease has been, overwhelmingly in Black and Latino low-income communities, and trying to rush the resources there to make sure that people can get vaccinated. Fortunately, things are changing a little bit, and things that we should have done from the beginning, relying on community clinics, using mobile vaccine efforts, et cetera, and working with local community-based organizations and people in the community, promotoras, health promoters who can get the word out. Those things are beginning to happen. So it was a problem. The problem has been recognized. We're beginning to address it. I hope we don't continue to replicate this problem going forward.
Erica, you spent some time volunteering at a community health clinic. This is the Kedron Community Health Center in South LA. We've actually put a spotlight on it here on this program. You noticed something interesting, though, happening over there, right? The people getting vaccinated actually wanted to choose which vaccine they were going to get.
Yeah, the phrase I've heard most often is brand shopping, as in, I want Moderna or Pfizer or now Johnson & Johnson, which is now in the mix. And, you know, that's a concern. I think that public health officials have begun to recognize when we have more vaccines now. I mean, obviously it was Pfizer and Moderna first, and the messaging on that was pretty much the same, that the efficacy rating on both was north of 90%. You know, either one is going to, you know, spare you from being in the hospital, spare you most likely from death. So get it. And now we have Johnson & Johnson, which same thing. We'll spare you from being in the hospital. We'll spare you from death. But the numbers and the way that the clinical trials were being done were a little bit different. Therefore, the messaging is a little bit different. And so now we have clinics, in this case, Kedron, that was offering both, the day I was there, both Pfizer and Moderna. I also spent some time there over the weekend in which they had Johnson & Johnson. And kind of the same thing was happening where people were getting to the front of the line after spending 2 hours there being like, you know, I don't want Johnson & Johnson. I want it Pfizer or I want it Moderna. So I think there is this aspect of now we have multiple choices of vaccines and people are hearing maybe their friends or their relatives got one or the other and had a good experience, had a bad experience, and now they want the same thing. So that's another, you know, an issue that I think we're going to have to confront as we talk about equity and getting people vaccinated.
Well, and vis-a-vis equity, I mean, we're talking about like the Johnson & Johnson shot may have less efficacy, right? But it's only one shot. So does that make it easier as far as equity goes?
Well, there's a couple things going on. I mean, the efficacy rating, comparing, you know, you can't really compare Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson apples to apples that way, in part because the time frame in which Moderna and Pfizer were tested is different than Johnson & Johnson and also under different conditions. So, for example, Johnson & Johnson was tested later on. It has tested on some of the variants that we've all been hearing about that have devastated so many communities in different parts of the world. And so its efficacy rating was compared to those variants where, say, Pfizer and Moderna, those did not come into play. And so you can't really compare the two that way. But that one shot that Johnson & Johnson does have, and also the fact that it doesn't have to be kept as cold as the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines, opens up a new level of flexibility in terms of equity. It's easier to take out into neighborhoods and trucks, to people who are homebound, to people who just basically don't want to stand in line or cannot stand in line for hours, for people who don't have vehicles. The one shot also makes it easier for people who work multiple jobs, for example, as essential workers and don't have, you know, 3-4 hours or more to not only sign up online and you know do the auto refresh on your computer, but also just literally stand in line for 2 hours to get a shot. So it's, you know, it's having these multiple different types of vaccines is going to be ultimately helpful. But I do think there's some messaging that has to take place to bring everybody up to speed about what their choices are and why they should just take whatever vaccine is given to them, basically.
Manuel, you say it's good for business too, right? I mean, talk about that.
Well, clearly, if you can get your essential workers to be vaccinated and safe at work, that's good for jumpstarting business. If you can make sure that you haven't got a public health emergency, that's good for the economy. But I think really the essential thing that's coming for me from this conversation, even around the Johnson & Johnson, I think around 2 months ago, I said, you know what, we should start thinking about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and how to market it, because it actually is quite a good vaccine in terms of farm workers who are moving from county to county, hard to reach communities, homeless, etc., because of the issue of one shot, less refrigeration, etc. And I feel like every time we come to a turning point, equity is sort of afterthought, where people slap their forehead and say, oh my gosh, we distributed vaccines and it's not equitable. Or we've got this third vaccine and people are wondering about it because they think that they're getting a second class vaccine. We have had a strategy up till now of not really putting equity first and centering it. We need to make sure that equity is baked in, not sprinkled on. And it means that we need to look forward to a post-vaccine Los Angeles and California. And when people finally begin to emerge, what kind of economic damage will they have suffered? What sort of mental trauma will they have gone through? How are we going to rush resources to the communities that need it most as we emerge? And instead of letting these communities be swept over by COVID, how do we act with equity first moving into the future?
Manuel, you're part of Governor Newsom's COVID recovery task force. As I mentioned, the state announced earlier this month that about 40% of the vaccine supply will go to its poorest residents, what you're talking about here. What does that mean for Los Angeles? I mean, where will those shots go specifically?
For Los Angeles, that's going to mean certainly South LA, the eastern San Fernando Valley, the southeast cities, and also a lot of cities in the San Gabriel area too that are also low income and low on that healthy places index. And again, this is going to be something that is good for business. First, they've set the requirements such that if you make sure that you're getting the vaccination vaccines into these low-income communities, that you will be able to open up the county a little bit faster. Also, this is where the essential workers are. This is where the workforce is, and really beginning to rush the resources there. But what it means and what it demands of us as a county is more mobile vaccination efforts, more vaccines going to the community clinics, more reliance on phone calls and door knocking rather than the internet, more face-to-face connections, more incorporation of community-based organizations, and more use of community wisdom in figuring out where the vaccines need to go, who we need to talk to, and how we need to get them there.
Erica, are there enough vaccines in the community, do you think? Are we getting enough vaccines?
No, I think that's the one thing that has been consistent throughout this vaccination effort. And, you know, that is something that comes from the federal government through the state on down to the county, is this idea that we just don't have enough vaccine to go around. I think that that has been at the heart of the fight in some ways over equity, is that you have different parts of the county and the city and the community that are pushing for vaccine. And there's high hope for Johnson & Johnson, given the fact that it's a newer vaccine. It's one more to the mix. Unfortunately, there are going to be supply shortages over the next few weeks, which means that basically the supply crunch isn't going away anytime in the near future. But at some point, we will have more in the supply chain. The Biden administration has vowed to get enough vaccine to every adult American in the next couple of months and make them eligible anyway. And so it looks like there's going to be that change. But for the time being, there isn't enough vaccine, I don't think, at any clinic in the county. And I do think that that has some effect on equity.
Certainly a conversation we're going to keep having over the coming weeks and months. As you say, Erica Smith, columnist of the LA Times, focusing on LA's diversity. Manuel Pastor, director of USC's Equity Research Institute. I want to thank you both.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us for Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. And now there are two Democrats out of five on a board of supervisors in a county that was once the bastion of conservatism in Southern California. It's a bluer hue in the county of Orange. Costa Mesa Mayor Katrina Foley will take the seat left open by Republican Michelle Steele, who went to Washington as Congresswoman. LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano is here to tell us more. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
Now, Steele beat an incumbent Democrat, so the narrative that Dems are surging, I guess, is not quite the whole story here. But it is a place, Gustavo, where just a couple of decades ago, Democrats were not even part of the conversation, right?
Yeah, no, this is, of course, Orange County, as I've said a trillion times, but I never tire of it, was the place that Reagan said all the good Republicans go to die. And it was super, super conservative for a long, long time. Although it's interesting with the Board of Supervisors, it actually was majority Democrat during the 1970s, but that's a whole other conversation. But now, yeah, there's two supervisors that are Democrat. And with the coming elections in 2022, the Democrats might have a chance to take it over for the first time in, geez, at this point, it would be like 45 years.
You predicted Foley would win. I mean, what was your thinking in that? How did you come to that prognostication?
Because I'm a prophet, Steve. We know this when it comes to Orange County.
Yes, you are.
The Mexican Jeremiah. But this is why Katrina won. Because she, even though she's a progressive Democrat, Costa Mesa is not historically has not been a super Democratic city. It's a city where you need to make peace with Republicans to be able to win elections. And so Katrina actually was a pretty mainstream candidate. More importantly, though, the Republican Party had two big candidates, a former supervisor, John Morlock, and the Mayor Pro Tem of Newport Beach, Kevin Muldoon, that essentially did a circular firing squad on themselves and allowed Katrina to be able to win. Because Katrina didn't get a majority of the vote, but she got enough to be able to trounce the other ones.
It was a plurality. Was there a big turnout for this special election?
It was a good turnout. I mean, nothing like the Trump turnout for the 2020 presidential election. But remember, this is most in Orange County now. It's interesting because everyone gets a mail ballot. So it's a month to be able to vote. You could either turn it in via mail. You can go to special ballot boxes, basically, and put them in or show up to Election Day. And so that's what happened this time. It was a month of elections.
I mean, you mentioned, you know, that they sort of circular firing squad. If you add up all the GOP candidate votes, I mean, you get just a little more than 50%. The Democrats would make up about 49%. Did the three GOP candidates get in each other's way? And would a Republican have won if this weren't, you know, if there weren't three in the original race?
It would have been tighter. Definitely tighter. Because Katrina's pretty popular in the area in Costa Mesa, although she did lose in the primary in the state Senate primary in 2020 to John Morlock, who then, of course, ended up losing to Democrat Dave Min. But this is interesting because the Republican Party historically in Orange County has been pretty disciplined. They basically say, wait your turn. If you're not getting it this time, we'll take care of you and we'll build you up. They had like this great, you know, to use a baseball metaphor, a great farm system. But especially with Trump caused all sorts of chaos. So this is exactly what happened in Orange County. Kevin Muldoon saying, hey, John Morlock, you old time Republican, get out of the way. Even though Morlock is, you know, is a line of conservatism in Orange County history.
I mean, the question, I guess, the ultimate question is this a fluke or a trend? And you're saying it is probably a trend, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Doug Chafee up in Northern Orange County, he became the first Democratic supervisor in about a decade. Now you have Katrina. You haven't had two. Whoa, you probably haven't had two since the 80s, if not the 70s. So now the next question becomes in the, you know, the first supervisorial district, which where Andrew Doe is, he just won re-election in 2020. So in 4 years, that's the most Democratic section of Orange County. He's going to be termed out. So it'll be interesting to see who's going to be running. And you know, the Democrats are going to throw everything possible to be able to get that majority.
To that majority of 3 out of 5 instead of now 2 out of 5. I mean, I know, again, let's talk about these seats themselves. They're actually nonpartisan. So while Foley did flip the seat, does it actually matter?
It does. Symbolically, it does, because you still, even though the County of Orange technically only governs the unincorporated areas in Orange County, which at this point is mostly South Orange County, a couple pockets of North and Central Orange County, but it's still in charge of the budget for the Sheriff's Department. It's still in charge of the healthcare agency. There's still a lot of billions of dollars passing through Orange County, which is, as a government, one of the largest countries in the United States. And this is a county, especially with coronavirus, where a lot of Democrats and progressives have been criticized the Board of Supervisors for not paying attention to coronavirus, you know, for a long time, not even believing it was a thing. If you have Democrats, ostensibly, then you're going to have a more caring Board of Supervisors, and that's how Democrats will be able to get power. Say Katrina stays there for a while, maybe she wants to hop up to higher office later on.
What's going to happen to that mayoral seat in Costa Mesa, the one that Foley's leaving?
That's going to be really interesting because over the past couple of years, Costa Mesa City Council is basically all new people between 2020 and 2018. This is not like long timers. Like in the past, you'd have someone like a Jim Righeimer, Gary Monahan. So maybe one of the people from the past of Costa Mesa, former mayor, might run. And also the mayoral seat has only been elected since 2018. So Katrina Foley technically has been the only elected mayor in Costa Mesa history. But now we're going to have number two. And you know, the Republicans and Democrats are going to be fighting like crazy for it.
Not crazy. Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times, here every week with KCRW's Orange County Line. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, a boulevard that's seen better days, how one thoroughfare in the valley has gone from cruise spot to blues spot, and how COVID made it worse. Check us out online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Check out the shows. Subscribe to the podcast, too, and share your thoughts at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, PJ Shahamet, Mario Saavedra, Amy Ta, Phil Richards, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all made the show happen this evening. I'm Steve Chitakis. Take care of yourself. Stay safe. Thanks for your ears tonight. Have a great night.